Hello and welcome to episode 3 of the Tanfield Talks podcast. This is Michael Walsh, and in this episode, I'm joined by my co-hosts Daniel Dovar and Tim Polly QC. This time we discuss the Court of Appeals judgment in Dillon and Barclays Bank and the Chief Land Registrar. This is a case about land registration, rectification and indemnity. We will also be making our predictions about what issues will be keeping property litigators busy over the next 6 months. And finally, we discuss the Corporate Insolvency and Governance Bill, currently making its way through Parliament. So let's turn to our analysis of Dillon and Barclays Bank and the Chief Land Registrar. Our very own Tim Polly QC acted for the successful bank in the Court of Appeal. Daniel, the facts in this case are highly unusual, aren't they?
Well, it's more your run-of-the-mill case of husband fraudulently obtaining council property in wife's name by duping her, her company, and a lender with a bit of a sheet thrown in for good measure. So Mrs. D was a council tenant and started the process of exercising her right to buy. And then she seems to have promptly forgotten about it and her application. But unfortunately, for all concerned, her husband, Mr. D, hadn't forgotten about it. He picked up where she left off, and by forging her signature, he managed to simultaneously purchase the property in his wife's name, transfer it to a company, CEL, Cell, who in turn mortgaged it on a buy-to-let mortgage from Barclays. But I think there's a nuance in the financing arrangement which is important. Isn't that right, Tim?
That's right. CEL acquired the property with short-term bridging finance. The Barclays charge was a remortgage, albeit one entered into very shortly after the acquisition. Now, the reason why I think that is important is that Barclays therefore relied on CEL's registration as proprietor of the house when advancing its loan and taking the charge. CEL was already the registered proprietor, and that was, we said, or should be, relevant to Barclays' right to receive an indemnity from the land registry in the case, or should it be the case, that Mrs. Dillon's claim had succeeded.
Yes, thanks for that. Just going back to the facts, though, and as a result, unbeknown to her, Mrs. D ended up residing in her home, but not as a tenant of the council, but as a tenant of CEL. They had the freehold title registered in their name, subject to Barclays' charge. So far, not good. But matters took a further twist. She returned home from abroad and discovered the fraud when CEL installed new tenants and started throwing out her belongings. CEL was eventually dissolved, with the result that their title devolved to the Crown, who promptly disclaimed it, giving rise to that well-known unmodern phenomenon of a sheet. Mrs. D then applied to the court to have the property vested in her name, which was successful. But so far, so still not good. Mrs. D had title to the property, but it was subject to Barclays' charge. She then sought to remove that.
That's right. Mrs. D had applied for a vesting order and, as you say, received the property into her name and applied to remove the bank's charge pursuant to paragraph 2 of Schedule 4 of the Land Registration Act 2002. Now, under paragraph 3.3 of Schedule 4, the court has to make the rectification unless there are exceptional circumstances which justify its not doing so. And that's the statutory phrase, exceptional circumstances which justify its not doing so. I ought to mention that the similar provision applies in the case of an alteration that doesn't amount to a rectification, but that provision is sort of hidden away in Rule 179 of the Land Registration Rules. But the same provision applies, whether it's a rectification or an alteration. And in this context, it probably makes sense to explain the difference between alteration and rectification and why it's important. So a rectification is an alteration that involves the correction of a mistake and prejudicially affects the title of a registered proprietor. The two leading authorities on when an alteration corrects a mistake are NRAM and Evans and subsequently Antoine and Barclays Bank. And very briefly, or by way of summary, they established that Whether an entry is a mistake has to be adjudged at the time it's made. The focus is therefore on the state of the register and not on the underlying disposition, and that there is a mistake when a disposition is registered or deleted from the register when it ought not to have been, or if it is recorded in a way which is inaccurate. The distinction between an alteration and an alteration that amounts to rectification is important, because if the alteration amounts to rectification, it will, in principle, give rise to an entitlement to an indemnity. Whereas if it's just an alteration that doesn't amount to a rectification, it won't. And in Dillon, the chief land registrar was concerned to try and ensure that if there was an alteration, an indemnity would not be payable.
Yes, that's right. So going back to Dillon, Tim, the trial judge had concluded that the court had jurisdiction to order the alteration sought by Mrs. Dillon, but that on the highly unusual facts of this case, there were exceptional circumstances why it should not do so. And Mrs. D appealed to the Court of Appeal. So, Tim, tell us, what did the Court of Appeal decide?
Well, the Court of Appeal agreed with the trial judge that there were exceptional circumstances that justified not making the alteration. And just leaving aside for the moment whether or not that alteration would have amounted to rectification or not, those exceptional circumstances were that because she had received CEL's equity of redemption, she was essentially in the same place as CEL. And in that position, she had no basis to set the mortgage aside. So she had to be winding the clock back to that point in time, that split second in time, between the receipt of the fraudulent transfer from Hackney and the fraudulent transfer onto CEL. And the problem with that is that Mrs. Dillon, if that's the nature of the alteration that she was seeking to make, Mrs. Dillon could never have been the freehold owner of the property other than by the fraud. She could never have afforded to buy the property without immediately selling it on. And because the original conveyance to her was void, if the register was rectified as she was asking it to be, the occupier would become the owner of the unencumbered property as a consequence of fraud.
Well, that's really interesting. Was there anything else in the decision, Tim, that you thought was interesting?
There are loads of interesting issues in the case. It was almost a sort of a land law exam question. But one of the interesting issues is how it is that Mrs. Dillon came to be registered as a proprietor at all, because it arose from a vesting order that had to have been made under Section 181 of the Insolvency Act 1986. That was made by Master Moncaster. And as it happens, the Court of Appeal were pretty sceptical about whether Mrs. Dillon was actually entitled to the order. They said that it remained unclear precisely how or why she was entitled to make the application or obtain the order in the first place. But of course, by the time that the Dillon trial came on, and even more so by the time the appeal came on, it was too late to challenge that. The order had to stand. But what the courts did have to decide was what the effect of that vesting order was. And Mrs. Dillon argued that she acquired a new freehold title free of the bank's charge. And I argued that the Moncaster order vested in Mrs. Dillon the same freehold title that CEL had, essentially that she acquired CEL's equity of redemption. Now, this is important because there are, in fact, two routes to obtaining a vesting order in circumstances such as this. And one route does create a new title. But when that route is followed, the order needs to be an order for the creation of a new title, and it needs to provide for the rights and the encumbrances that will affect that title. The Moncaster order didn't do that. It provided in terms that Mrs. Dillon was to have the title that CEL had prior to the prior to being struck off. So that is how I was able to argue that the order had to have been made under Section 181 of the Insolvency Act 1986. And if there was to be a vesting order, it was also appropriate for it to be made pursuant to Section 181 of the Insolvency Act 1986 because of the charge. It's an oddity that although the escheat determined the freehold estate, the registered charge, which was carved out of that freehold estate, remains. So And the land registration rules provide for this. So Rule 173 provides that where a registered freehold estate in land has determined, the registrar makes a note of that fact, or can make a note of that fact, in the property register and in the register of any inferior interest affected by the escheat of that registered title. And that's what was done in this case. So bizarrely, although the freehold, the CEL's freehold, had escheated, the Barclays charge remained with, for example, the mortgagee's right to sell that escheated freehold on as a mortgagee in possession. But that was a very interesting issue. But the most interesting issues, in fact, I think, were the ones that I raised but were not expressly decided by the Court of Appeal. And so they live on for argument on another occasion.
Yeah, that's fascinating, Tim. I think that you're right. It is an exam question for any future undergraduates out there. So pay attention. You're right that this was decided on a number of assumptions, wasn't it? And in which the court didn't make any decisions. And the Court of Appeal proceeded on the assumption without deciding, for example, that it had jurisdiction to make the alteration sought by Mrs. Dillon, because the operative mistake in this case was the replacement of Hackney as proprietor of the property with CEL. And Barclays had argued there was no jurisdiction.
That's right. I think for my money, that is the most interesting issue of all, because it's an absolutely fundamental issue going to the core of the way that the land registration scheme works.
Mm. And the court also assumed, again, without deciding, that the principle of illegality didn't preclude Mrs. Dillon from bringing her claim, because the bank had argued that Mrs. Dillon was seeking to adopt and benefit from the fraud that was perpetrated on Hackney by her husband. And the principle of illegality, as explained in Patel and Mirza, precluded her from doing that. However, the court observed that the inescapable fact that Mrs. Dillon is seeking to wind the clock back to a point in time between the two fraudulent transfers means that inevitably she is seeking to rely on the first act of fraud, namely the void transfer one, and it would be contrary to common sense and any notion of justice to consider the question of exceptional circumstances, and perhaps more particularly whether or not the non-rectification of the register was justified without having regard to that fact. Now, the Chief Land Registrar argued that Mrs. Dillon had been in actual and obvious occupation of the property at all material times, and her right to rectification constituted an overriding interest that took priority over the bank's charge. That means that the alteration that Mrs. Dillon sought wasn't rectification at all. And we know the reason that they were arguing that was that the consequence was that if the alteration had been ordered, an indemnity wouldn't have been available to the bank and the land registry wouldn't have had to have paid out. And this issue wasn't determined because the appeal was dismissed.
That's right. And it's a shame it wasn't determined, because it's a potential problem in situations like this. But it is one that is on the Law Commission's radar, and they have recommended that it be resolved with a statutory provision providing that the so-called right to rectify cannot be an overriding interest.
There's one final practical point that arises from this final argument which will have, I think, general applicability. The Court of Appeal said that the point wasn't pleaded and it therefore wasn't open to the Chief Land Registrar to run it. This is another recent example of the Court of Appeal warning parties that they must not raise unpleaded issues at trial or on appeal. And the Dillon judgment repeats the warning that was also recently given by Lord Justice David Richards in UK Learning Academy and Secretary of State for Education, where he said if the trial judge said there was a prevailing view that the party should not be held to their pleaded case, it is wrong.
Yes, that's right. I think this is an increasing trend of the courts re-emphasizing the importance of pleadings. Once a trial starts, some barristers seem to proceed as though the case can just evolve as the evidence and the arguments play out. And in a way it does, but that evolution is always in the context of the pleaded case. If a party wants essentially to change its case as a consequence of how the evidence or the arguments have played out, then it needs to amend its pleadings, even if that happens mid-trial.
Well, a fascinating case, Tim. And it's worth noting Mrs. Dillon sought but was refused permission to appeal to the Supreme Court. Any update on that?
As it happens, I received an email 35 minutes ago confirming that the application for permission has been renewed to the Supreme Court itself.
And we should say today's date is the 11th of June. So watch this space if you are listening at another time. So let's move on. There's no doubt the legal landscape over the next 6 months looks uncertain. We're going to now try to predict some of the issues that are going to be important. So I'll start us off. My prediction is that over the next 6 months, we are going to see a spike in the appointment of fixed charge receivers, especially in the context of commercial lending. As to the residential consumer market, I think it's harder to predict. During the last recession in 2009, listeners will recall the government provided a huge amount of support for borrowers in owner-occupied regulated mortgages. My gut feeling is that the government will want to limit the number of possession claims by banks. And in fact, very recently, the Financial Conduct Authority announced that firms regulated by them should not commence, continue, or enforce possession proceedings until the 31st of October. October 2020, and indeed they've said that to do so is likely to be a breach of MCOB. I think we're unlikely to see receivers being appointed over mortgage or, that is, borrower-occupied properties, because members of UK Finance, which is the trade body for the banking and finance industry, and which merged with the Council of Mortgage Lenders, don't do so. It is also, I think, worth mentioning at this time that we have the announcement that Practice Direction 51Z is likely to be extended until the end of August, although there is no announcement as to the content or how that will be achieved at this time. So what else do you think is going to be keeping property litigators busy in the next 6 months, Tim?
Well, sadly, lots of individuals and businesses will have found the lockdown very difficult. So there's bound to be a glut of forfeiture work, tenants wanting to exercise break clauses, insolvency-related issues, more generally in the pipeline.
Yeah, I think also there's going to be, we're going to see a lot more Section 17 notices flying around. That's Section 17 of the Landlord and Tenant Covenants Act 1995, where a landlord wants to claim rent or service charges from a former tenant or their guarantor who are liable for them. The Act places a six-month time limit for the landlord to make that claim against the former tenant or guarantor that it wants to recover those sums from. There is some debate about the content of those notices, but I also imagine that there's going to be a number of pot shots at the validity of those notices and possibly service issues of those notices. Service is a perennial issue that comes up in litigation, and I can imagine it's only going to get worse given the closure of offices and remote working. So I can see many arguments to try and overcome the six-month time limit on that.
Well, I can say from my own personal knowledge that that's already started in respect of the March quarter day. And of course, the June quarter day is fast approaching.
Yeah, it's going to be a seriously big growth area for property litigators, I think, in the next few months. Tim, Daniel, what are your thoughts on my prediction in relation to receivership? Tim first.
I think inevitably you are right that there will be an increase in receivership. And that means an increase in borrowers trying in some way to force the disinstruction of those receivers.
Daniel?
Yes, although we have also had, I think you've touched on the bill that's going through Parliament at the moment, the Corporate Insolvency and Governance Bill, and it's a point we're going to deal with in a moment. There is some breathing space being given to companies as well in order to carry on trading. So there may be quite a bit of tension in that regard as the government recognises that it wants to keep going businesses that would otherwise have continued, not but for the financial implications of the virus.
Well, an excellent segue. Daniel. On that, the Corporate Insolvency and Governance Bill has had its third reading in the House of Commons and is off to the House of Lords on the 16th of June, with the third reading there slated for the 23rd of June. So it's likely to become law in late June or early July. Daniel, would you like to tell us what are the headlines for real estate from this bill?
Well, as I've said, the government are concerned with the impact of the coronavirus on businesses generally. They're legislating to mitigate some of the issues arising from the financial losses that those businesses have faced as a result of lockdown as well. And it's important to note that this isn't just in the letting or the real estate sector. This is across the board in relation to claims against businesses. So the way the government is doing this, it's firstly, temporarily preventing winding up proceedings being taken on the basis of statutory demands. So during the crisis, landlords have been using statutory demands to encourage payment from tenants who don't want to pay rent during the coronavirus, but maybe were able to do so. The problem with that is if the statutory demand isn't satisfied, landlords can use it as evidence that a company can't pay its debts and force the company into liquidation in order to recover the money that's owed to them. So now, when the bill comes into force, no winding up petition can be presented after the 27th of April 2020 based on a statutory demand served during the period between the 1st of March 2020 and the 30th of June 2020, although that date may get shifted depending on when the legislation actually comes into force. So that's winding up petitions based on statutory demands. The second element is that there's also a temporary stop on winding up petitions where the coronavirus has had a financial effect on the company and has caused the grounds for the proceedings. So what this means in practice is that no petition can be presented after the 27th of April 2020 based on a company's inability to pay its debts or other relevant grounds, unless the creditor satisfies what is termed the coronavirus condition. And there are two alternatives for that. The first is that the creditor has reasonable grounds for believing that coronavirus has not had a financial effect on the company. I can find that that's quite a high hurdle because it's, you know, whether or not it's causative of it, most companies are going to have had some of financial effect by the virus. The second one is probably more relevant, is that the relevant grounds for presenting the petition would have arisen even if the coronavirus had not had a financial effect on the company. So those are the coronavirus conditions.
The coronavirus condition is interesting because the government are clearly weeding out the businesses that were failing before the pandemic struck.
Yeah, exactly. So in reality, most businesses, as I've said, will have been affected financially by the virus in one form or another. So as a result of that, not many creditors will be able to rely on the first ground unless they can prove to the court that it has reasonable grounds to believe that non-payment of rent is not caused by the coronavirus. So it's a pretty hard and high threshold for landlords and shows the robustness of the government's response.
Well, controversially, the government has decided that the bill should have retrospective effect in some respects by giving a power to the court to rescind winding up orders that have already been made. Is that right, Daniel?
Yes, this is reflective of the fact that maybe they can't push the legislation through or didn't want to push the legislation through too early, but wanted to send certainly a message out to everybody to say, although it's not in force, if you act in a way that's contrary to the act prior to it coming into force, we can wind the clock back. So some of the measures which the bill proposes include giving the court the power to restore the company to its position prior to the presentation of the petition in respect of any petition presented after the 27th of April 2020, but before the bill becomes law, if the court is satisfied the creditor presented the petition without meeting the coronavirus condition. And there are a number of other circumstances in which matters can be rolled back. So there's plenty of protection there for debtors.
Yes, and we've seen actually that the High Court is already prepared to restrain the presentation or advertisement of petitions just based on the fact that the bill will become law, it is anticipated. So it's already having an effect. And we talked about these general protections in the last episode and discussed whether the government might bring forward measures that give companies more breathing space. As expected, this is quite debtor-friendly. friendly as a piece of legislation, and it's geared towards the rescue culture. In fact, there are also provisions in clause 12 of the bill that disapply contractual terms that allow suppliers of goods and services to discontinue supply if the debtor company enters into an insolvency procedure. Although there is a discretion that the court can reapply those provisions if it would cause financial hardship to the supplier, there are also exceptions from this, of course, for small companies.
That's right. It ought to be stressed that these provisions are of general application. So returning to a point that Dan was saying earlier, guarantors faced with claims on a guarantee are as able to rely on these provisions as anyone else, provided, of course, that they satisfy the conditions. It's also worth mentioning, however, that the bill deals with companies and corporate debtors and so on, and it doesn't include the same level of protection for individuals. So there might still be routes for recovery for some creditors that are worth exploring.
It does call into question what action landlords can take at the moment, doesn't it?
Yeah, and in terms of obtaining possession of the properties for any default, it appears that they're just going to have to wait even longer for the stay on forfeiture proceedings in general, which is about to be extended, we're told, until 23rd of August. We don't really know whether even that's the final date, as the government might even extend the time period to October in the same way that it's done for mortgage holiday requests. So what the bill does, though, is it, I think, and indeed most of these provisions, is to try and encourage landlords and tenants, creditors and debtors to negotiate payment terms in order to avoid litigation, and whether that be by rent holiday or temporary rent reductions. So I think that's the purpose, is to get people talking in order to try and find a way over the difficulties that everyone is experiencing.
It's probably not very reassuring for a lot of creditors, but hopefully the provisions will keep companies solvent and their businesses viable, which in the long term is probably better for landlords in terms of collecting rent. Well, we'll leave it there. Thanks to my co-hosts, Daniel Dovar and Tim Polly QC. Thank you to you for listening, and until next time, goodbye.